Okay, this is time to start. I was not aware that I had to introduce David, but of course I know him very well. I think he started in 2016,
yes.
David?
Yeah.
Studying in Grenoble Engineer School, and then he wanted to attend the JUAS. So he came to see me, and then he wanted to attend the JUAS and do an internship. And I was looking at that time for someone, and then you decided to go to do a technical student with Niccolo Biancacci to study what?
To study the transverse mode coupling
instability
in
the LHC, starting with an internship, and then you did a PhD with him.
Yep.
A lot of very interesting simulation, measurements, and an excellent PhD thesis. And then you moved to Soleil to do a fellowship for 2 years. Unfortunately, it was during the COVID time. Nevertheless, I think it was a great experience. Yeah. And then he came back because we wanted to have a fellow to work on the muon collider for 3 years. And this is what you did, I think, February 2022 to end of January 2025. So 3 years, and during these 3 years, he did really an amazing work that he will present today. And since the 1st of February, you are now fellow at EPFL, continuing to work on collective effects on a very important subject, which is the one on ionizing cooling, but I think this is all what you will explain. It has been a great pleasure to work with you for all these years. Let's continue. Thank you in advance.
Thank you, Elias, for the introduction. I think, can you hear me correctly? I hope it's not so good. Maybe. Is it better? Also, I think this. Ouais, normalement, il est allumé, c'est juste, il est un peu. Ou alors je prends le micro main. Is it better? Okay, perfect. And this, I was testing it. It was okay. That's strong push. Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. So thank you, Elias, for the introduction. So as Elias mentioned, I will be presenting the work that I did over the last 3 years as a Sun Fellow, and that I'm now continuing as an EPFL scientist. So this work is part also of the International Muon Collider Collaboration and the European MUCOL project. And so I will talk about the challenges from collective effects inside the muon collider. So I will first start with an overview of the muon collider, of the whole complex. Then I will just highlight some of the possible collective effects that we can encounter, just a small selection, and then to go on the collective effects inside the muon collider itself. So first, for the overview of the muon collider. So the main driver for the design of this complex is the muon decay. The muon decay with a lifetime at rest of 2.2 microseconds. But then if we can accelerate them to high enough energy, this lifetime, thanks to special relativity, can become 104 milliseconds for an energy of 5 TeV. Now, the challenge is, of course, to produce enough muons and anti-muons, accelerate them quickly to then reach the collider and have high luminosity experiments in the collider. So all the chain design is driven by this this challenge. So we start with a high power proton proton driver that generates high power protons that hit a target. Then after hitting the target, we generate muons, anti-muons, and pions that are then transported towards the cooling channels, where they undergo 6D cooling to reach the target emittance in longitudinal and the transverse plane. Then once we reach the characteristic we want for the for muons and anti-muon bunches, we have to accelerate them very quickly to counterbalance the muon decay effect. And once they have been accelerated, we bring them inside the collider. And since we have only two bunches, one muon and one anti-muon bunches, we'll have two experimental points, two high luminosity experiments. So now I will go a bit through the different parts and show some of the challenge for these different parts. So the first part is, I said, the proton driver. So we need a high power proton beam. We have in the study two options, at 2 megawatts or 4 megawatts. So meaning a 5 GeV or 10 GeV proton beam, 5 × 10⁴ protons on the target in a 2 nanosecond bunch with a 5 hertz repetition rate. So this is something that is comparable to the European Spallation Source LINAC that has a 5 megawatt and 2 GeV LINAC operating at 14 hertz. Then this proton beam is sent towards a target, a Greifswald target. This target is immersed in a solenoidal field generated by high temperature superconductors. To protect this HTS magnet, this target and the whole complex is inside a tungsten shield to shield the coils from from radiation and dissipate the heat load generated by the proton collision on the target. So after the target, we get a mix of muons, anti-muons, pions, positive and negative pions. The pions will further decay into more muons and anti-muons in the decay channel afterwards. And then so we get muons and anti-muons. Then these muon and anti-muon beams need to be cooled down to reach the target emittance. So for this, we use ionization cooling provided by liquid hydrogen absorbers. So here we have a schematic of the cell, of one cell of the muon cooling channels. So the muon and anti-muon beam or anti-muon beams arrive through here. They cross the absorber. Then they will lose energy in all the planes in 6D. But then we have RF cavities to provide back some of the lost longitudinal momentum, so that we don't stop the muon beams with the series of absorber. These cavities and these absorber are themselves embedded inside the solenoidal field to have to maintain the transverse focusing. So we have this the muon beam. They undergo this trajectory in the emittance space. So we have in this plot the transverse and longitudinal emittance. So we start with very large beam. We see something in the tens of millimeter transverse emittance, and then they will undergo so the cooling. So we'll have several order of magnitude emittance reduction in transverse and longitudinal, and then in the what we call the final cooling, they will undergo the last transverse emittance cooling, while regaining a bit of longitudinal emittance. So once we have reached this point, we have a 25 micrometer radian transverse emittance, 100 millimeter longitudinal emittance. The beams are sent towards the acceleration chain. So the acceleration chain, we need to accelerate very quickly our muons and anti-muon bunches. So for this, we have superconducting LINACs, recirculating LINACs, and we have a chain of 4 rapid cycling synchrotrons that will provide most of the energy swing before reaching the collider. So we need a very large RF voltage in all of these rapid cycling synchrotrons. For example, we have 90 gigavolt of RF and 3,000 cavities in RCS4 that will accelerate from 750 from 1.5 TeV to 5 TeV the muons and anti-muon bunches. To follow this large energy increase pattern, we need very fast ramping magnet. So, for example, in the RCS1, the smallest machine of the four, we have magnets ramping at 4.2 kilotesla per second. Particularity in the design of RCS 2, 3, and 4 is that these are hybrid synchrotrons, so alternating fixed field superconducting dipoles at 10 tesla and pulsed normal conducting dipoles oscillating between minus 1.8 and plus 1.8 Tesla. So this allows to increase the energy swing, but we have orbit excursions inside the magnet. This is what is shown on this plot. So we have here a dipole cell of the one cell of the RCS2, so the first hybrid synchrotron in the chain, and where we have a superconducting magnet, fixed field, a normal conducting magnet, and then another superconducting magnet. And we see at injection the beam trajectory, so the blue curve here, and we see that the superconducting magnet is providing too much deflection to the beam, that is then compensated by the normal conducting magnet that is at minus 1.8 Tesla at injection energy. And then the other superconducting magnet will put back the beam on the correct trajectory. But then at ejection energy, at extraction energy, the top energy, the magnets will all work together to provide an overall deflection of the beam. So once we have reached the 5 TeV per beam, thanks to the acceleration chain and the RCS, we reach the collider ring. And in the collider, the goal is to achieve high luminosity at two experimental points. So for this, we need small beta star insertions in at two locations, together with the high bunch intensity of 1.8 10 to the 11 muons or anti-muons per bunch, and the 5 hertz repetition rate. Meanwhile, we also must minimize the intensity loss caused by muon decay. So we need a ring that is as compact as possible, which means high field dipoles has high field as we can reach for the dipole magnets. So all this together, this makes the lattice design very challenging. The strong, the small beta star is achieved by having very strong final focusing magnets before the interaction point. And in the lattice design, in this example version of the lattice design, there are beta functions reaching several hundreds of kilometers before the interaction point. So what I showed here is what we are currently studying as the baseline muon collider is a greenfield study. So independent of any seating or of any placement in any lab. In the collaboration, we have also been studying some possible implementation either on the CERN site or on the Fermilab site. Here I show a possible schematic of the accelerator layout reusing the existing CERN tunnels. So we could reuse the LINAC-4 and extend it to then feed the proton driver that could be placed on the Prefsin site. And then we could have the cooling channels and the recirculating LINACs located on the Prefsin site. And we could reuse maybe the SPS and LHC tunnel to host the rapid cycling synchrotron. And then a ring for the collider would need to be built, a 10-kilometer ring. And then its placement, its location would have to be studied carefully to minimize the neutrino flux while placing it as much as possible on CERN lens. There's also been studies for a muon cooling test facility located at CERN or somewhere else to really assess the performance we could reach with the cooling and how we can operate the cooling channels. So this was for the overview of the muon collider complex. Now I will quickly show some examples of collective effects. It's not an exhaustive list, far from it. Collective effects we encounter in accelerators is direct space charge. So in a bunch of charged particles, the particle will feel a Coulomb repulsion. But then once they are put in motion, they will generate a magnetic field, an attractive magnetic field that will compensate this Coulomb repulsion. However, at low energy, this compensation is not enough to compensate the Coulomb repulsion. So we can have issues of emittance blow-up, etc., because of space charge or instabilities driven by space charge, particular for the low energy machines. This is of concern, in the, for example, for the ionization cooling part, where the energy, the beta are of the order of 0.2. This force also, it depends on the distribution of the particle, and for Gaussian distribution, it's non-linear, so it makes the study quite complex. Another very big class of effects, of collective effects, are impedance and wake fields. So as the charged bunch go through through the machine, they interact electromagnetically with their environment, can be the RF cavities, like in this example. So we see the bunch crossing the RF cavity, and it's leaving some electromagnetic field inside that can be trapped for long or short times, depending on the cavity geometry and properties. And then these electromagnetic field, we can model the effect, model the ensemble of this electromagnetic field with what we call impedance and wake fields. So impedance in frequency domain, wake field in time domain. They are the Fourier transform of each other, to characterize all these interactions. We can do this for the different equipments, and we can estimate this impedance and wake field with 3D electromagnetic simulation, like this one, or analytical models, or a mix of the two. Then, with this impedance and wake field models, we can simulate the effect those have on the bunch, and we can simulate the dynamic of the bunch as it's going through the machine. So here I show an example of the ETEL signal, so the part the bunch transverse position over turn after turn. So each line is the different signal for one turn, and we see that the bunch is having some oscillation transverse, and if this oscillation grows too quickly, then the bunch can be lost in the accelerator, in some of the accelerator components. So all these effects can be mitigated, can be reduced with the careful design of the different equipments, the choice of materials, etc. So this is also a collaborative work with the engineering, RF, optics, vacuum teams to design as best as possible the machine. Last class of effects I show here are beam-beam interaction. So our bunch or charged bunch generate an electromagnetic field, and then when the muons and anti-muons bunch cross each other at the interaction point, the particles in one bunch will see the electromagnetic field generated by the other bunch, creating a force on this that can then perturb the motion of the particle and generate instabilities. Again, this force depend on the bunch distribution, they depend on the bunch separation, and they are non-linear. So after this not exhaustive view of possible collective effects in general, I will show some of the studies that were done for the specifically for the muon collider. So starting with this list that was laid out in 2021. So it's a list of the priorities for the beam dynamics studies inside the muon collider that was made at the start when the collaboration was started. So I won't go through all these items. I will just highlight that what I will show in the next slides, it's the impedance models that were developed, the beam dynamics studies during acceleration, so in the rapid cycling synchrotron, as well as in the collider rig. So going back to the rapid cycling synchrotron, part of the acceleration chain of the muon collider. So as I said, this rapid cycling synchrotron, this chain of four accelerators, have their goal is to accelerate the muon beams from an energy of around 60 GeV to the final energy in the collider of 5 TeV per beam. So for this, we have a chain of four rapid cycling synchrotrons, one normal pulsed RCS, and three hybrid RCS. bringing the beam from 60 GeV to 300 GeV, then to 750 GeV, then to 1.5 TeV, and then finally to 5 TeV. That was saying we need very large RF voltage in all these machines. So RCS4 that has the largest RF voltage, 90 gigavolt and 3000 cavities. This means that for all these machines, we'll have a kind of specific beam dynamics regime. We have very high synchrotron tune. For the first RCS, this synchrotron tune is of the order of 1.5 at injection. There's no typo. It's not missing a power. Whereas in classic synchrotrons, we are more in the order of 10 to the minus 3 for the synchrotron tune. If we were able to lump all the RF cavities in one location, we would not have a longitudinal phase space stability. We need to distribute all the RF cavities into multiple RF stations, so at least 20 in the different machines to preserve longitudinal phase space focusing. Then the second challenge is that since we need fast ramping magnets in this machine, the vacuum chamber in this accelerator cannot be made of classic metallic chamber. We would create too large eddy currents. So we need some solution to minimize eddy current losses while allowing to have a vacuum chamber. So the first item that was studied for collective effects was the impedance for the generated by the RF cavities, because as I said, we have many RF cavities in all the different RCS. And so the baseline cavity that was selected for the study is the 1.3 gigahertz superconducting Tesla cavity, because they can reach very high gradient in a compact form. So 30 megavolt meter per cavity is assumed for the study. But then the issue is that this cavity, they will create higher order modes that can affect the transverse beam stability. So we studied two variants of this cavity, the classic Tesla cavity that is used at European XFEL, and that is also the ILC baseline, as well as the low loss type cavity that is a variation of this Tesla cavity that was optimized to reach higher gradient, but at the cost of stronger higher order modes. And then creating the impedance model, the Wakefield model, we get something like this. So we have a list of higher order modes for our cavity. Then they translate into resonances in the impedance model. So we see here a zoom between 1 gigahertz and 4 gigahertz in the impedance, and we have the real part of the transverse dipolar impedance. So we see a large number of modes for this low loss cavity, and for the Wakefield, so in time domain, this translates as this. So we have in blue the curve, the Wakefield for the Tesla, the classic Tesla cavity. In orange, the one for the low loss Tesla cavity. And we see that for the range of interest, that is the span of our bunch lengths, one sigma z, so around 20 picoseconds for our machines, we see that we have quite a large difference. This is a logarithmic scale on the y-axis. We have quite a large difference between the Tesla cavity and the low loss cavity. So already from the impedance model, we can estimate that the Tesla cavity should be better than the classic low loss cavity. But we'll see with beam dynamics simulation, we'll assess this in more detail. The second part that was studied for the impedance model of the rapid cycling synchrotron was the vacuum chamber for the pulsed magnet. So as I said, with the large ramp rate, if we had a metallic vacuum chamber, we would melt the chamber because of eddy current losses. So this was a study done by Eric Vickney, who was a technical student with us for one year. He studied in detail all this vacuum chamber for the pulsed magnet. And he showed that, okay, he made the estimate for a classic metallic chamber of the losses in a metallic chamber that can reach megawatts per meter. So really way too high loss for a beam pipe. But then by going to a striped design, so cutting, let's say, the metallic chamber in stripes, this can be dramatically reduced to then acceptable level. This is something that this is not something new. Of course, for machines that have rapid cycling synchrotron, like J-Park in Japan, they have this kind of cavities where we have they have a ceramic chamber with longitudinal stripe to maintain the electrical conductivity for the beam image current. So then, this kind of chamber, it was modeled with impedance wave 2D. So their impedance was modeled, and I will show just after an example study checking the impact of inner metallic coating inside a 10 millimeter radius chamber with a 5 millimeter thick ceramic, and then checking what should be the coating thickness to shield the ceramic that is behind the coating. And this will be used by the vacuum and the magnet design team to check, so first the feasibility of such coating, and then checking that we can get this coating and that we get a good balance between impedance, vacuum requirements, and magnet requirements. So this is an example result. So we have the blue curve on this plot of the real part of the transverse dipolar impedance versus frequency. So the blue curve is for the uncoated case, so the beam seeing directly the ceramic material. And we see that for frequencies around 1 gigahertz or above 1 gigahertz, we have a lot of resonances appearing, a bit like the RF cavities. This would be detrimental for beam stability. These are stronger resonances. So, but then adding a metallic coating, for example, 100 nanometer metallic coating, that's the green curve, we can strongly damp these resonances and go to a more acceptable level for the vacuum chamber impedance. So this was the impedance modeling studies. So then, I said in introduction, these models, we can use them to simulate the beam dynamics of our two muons and anti-muon bunches. So for this, we perform tracking simulation for the full RCS chain, for the four machines in the chain. And then we check the beam properties once we have reached the end of the chain. And we must ensure that we keep the transverse longitudinal emittance of the bunch, so we don't degrade the property for the collider. So we perform macroparticle tracking simulation with the X-Suite framework. We track in this the examples I will show, we have a single muon bunch tracked to the four RCS. So we'll generate a muon bunch before the first RCS. It will be tracked. And since the acceleration is extremely fast, we only the beam is accelerated in only 17 turns in this machine. Then we take the beam properties, we inject it in the second RCS, where it's accelerated for 55 turns. Then it's sent to the RCS number 3 and then to the RCS number 4. And we looked at the properties at the end of our RCS number 4. Then, as I said, the RF cavities and their impedance model has to be splitted, has to be distributed along the ring. So we distribute them in 32 stations in each RCS. So this is an example of the tracking simulation through the chain of four machines. So here we see the longitudinal phase space of our bunch. As it's going through the different machines, we see it's going through RCS1, then RCS2. Its energy is increasing very fast. And we see that between when we inject from one RCS to the other, our parameters were not fully optimized. So we have some small injection mismatch between two RCS. It creates some filamentation inside the bunch. This could be solved by really configuring, getting the parameter perfectly right. And then we can look at all the properties, different properties of the bunch. So this is what is shown here. We can look at the longitudinal emittance of the bunch. So it's matched to 7.5 MeV meter at the start of RCS1. But we see that there is so a small amount of emittance blow up in the first RCS. Then when we inject into from one RCS to the other, we see another small amount of emittance blow up. And we see also some few losses from particles that were not captured at the start of at the start of acceleration. Then that was for the longitudinal plane. Then in the transverse plane, so the what is the wake field and impedance or impedance doing on our bunch dynamics? This is what we see for the transverse beam properties. So we our F cavities, they generate very strong wake field that can really disrupt the beam motion. And this is what we see in this simulation. We have a very strong instability appearing only a few turns after the injection inside RCS1. This is a logarithmic scale for the transverse bunch emittance. And we see that the bunch emittance is completely blown up after a few few turns. The bunch is not not good for to be used for the collider. But then in this simulation, we can introduce some mitigation measures. For example, we can introduce a transverse damper that will damp these oscillations, or we can introduce chromaticity inside the ring that will also help cure these instabilities. And in this example, with positive chromaticity and transverse damper, we see that the emittance is preserved along the chain of four RCS, and there is no transverse oscillation of the bunch. So this was one example study. Then we made also a systematic parametric study checking different different parameters. So I was saying we checked the difference between low loss and Tesla cavities, between two models of cavities. We checked also the effect of the transverse damper strengths from no damper, that's the infinite here, to for a strong four-ton damper. We also checked the effect of an initial transverse offset, so simulating an injection jitter from no offset to a 1 millimeter offset. And we checked also the effect of chromaticity, checking which amount of chromaticity we would need to cure the instability. And so we get this kind of heat map. So in yellow, it means that we have a very strong emittance blow up in the machine. So this is not good. In blue, it means that the emittance is preserved in the machine. But what we see is that with the low loss cavity, even with chromaticity, with strong chromaticity and transverse damper, there's only a few cases where we can preserve the emittance. But then switching to the Tesla cavity that has a lower transverse wake field, we recover some stability. We can accept some initial offset. And with a chromaticity of 20 units, we can have also any kind of transverse damper to stabilize the beam. So these were simulations, so some example simulation for the rapid cycling synchrotron, not moving to the last ring of the chain, the 10 TeV collider. The challenge in the 10 TeV collider is that we have short bunch lengths, 1.5 millimeter, one sigma z, and large large energy energy spread, 10 to the minus 3. So the if we wanted to bunch to have RF in this this machine to bunch these beams, we would need very large RF voltage. It's gigavolt in the gigavolt range if we have the slippage factor to 10 to the minus 6, which is already quite a small number. So this would mean then very long straight section, and this would be impractical. We would lose space in the ring. So operation with minimal RF is foreseen, just a few cavities to compensate the energy loss from synchrotron radiation, from a very low amount of synchrotron radiation that we have. So this means correcting the slippage factor to zero, and we get then an isochronous ring. The longitudinal phase space motion is would be completely frozen. Then for the impedance model, in this machine, the main element, the main driver would be the resistive wall impedance. So if we look at a schematic view of the magnets, of the collider magnets, most of the circumference would be occupied by dipole magnets. So the two beams travel in the same aperture, since we have only two bunches. They travel in the same aperture, and then the dipole field is given by superconducting coils. The issue is that as muons decay, they decay into electrons and positrons, we need to protect these superconducting coils from radiation damage and the heat load generated by this by the muon decay product. So for this, inside the cold bore, there would be a tungsten liner for 3-4 centimeter thick to intercept the muon decay product and protect the superconducting coil. So the muon beam, they would see first the tungsten liner. So we need to evaluate the impedance of this this element. So assuming a 10 kilometer resistive wall impedance generated by this tungsten liner, what we'll do is a scan of the chamber radius to check to find the minimal radius that is admissible for collective effects. So the minimum radius below which we would be affected by collective effects, and then this will serve. This will be used as an input for the magnet design team to build a radial build of the magnet and design the magnet. So we studied different configuration for this this beam pipe. So the tungsten shield is 40 millimeter thick, and then we studied case where we had a copper coating inside and different thickness of copper coating. So this is the impedance model that are shown here. So we have the still the transverse dipolar impedance as a function of frequency for different case. So the blue curve is for a copper tube. So checking the case for low resistivity material, and then the orange curve on top is the for a pure tungsten pipe, so tungsten having a higher resistivity than copper, its impedance is therefore higher. And then we have intermediate case, so case where we have a copper coating in the inner radius of the tungsten pipe and varying different copper coating thickness, so from 0.1 micrometer, it's the brown curve, to 100 micrometer, the green curve, and we see that this model lie between the copper and the tungsten models. So again, to show a bit the stability simulation, the tracking simulation inside the collider ring. So one particularity, of course, is that in the collider ring, our muon beam, they will decay. We leave them decay inside the collider. So the muon half-life at 5 TeV is 72 milliseconds. This corresponds to 2,000 turns in the collider ring. So the luminosity of the collider will quickly decrease after the few hundred or thousand of turns. So we really need to preserve the emittance and the beam characteristic for the few hundred thousand of initial turns inside the collider. But then the muon decay, since the bunch intensity will decrease over time, this is an important effect to include inside the simulation, because this will help from a collective effect side. As the intensity is decreasing, the collective effect strength will decrease as well. So this is what was added inside the simulation. So here we see the longitudinal phase space of the bunch inside the collider. Since the ring is isochronous, we see that there is no synchrotron motion. So the particles are fixed in phase space, but we see the particles disappearing over time because of the muon decay. But still, even with this effect that is helping us, we can still see some instability appearing. Here in this example, we see the transverse emittance blowing up over a few hundred of turns, we see an oscillation developing over 8,000 turns, despite the fact that we have the muon decay effect included. But this instability, it can be quite easily cured by introducing some small positive or negative chromaticity. We'll introduce some tune spread inside the bunch, mitigating this instability. Again, these effects, they were studied parametrically, so checking the effect of different chromaticity values, damper setting, initial bunch offset, to find good working point parameters for the collider. Okay, now back to the study of the what is the minimal chamber radius we can achieve inside the collider. So we use this tracking simulation that I just showed with the different impedance models that were generated. So we generated a scan in the chamber radius, so from 9 millimeter radius to 24 millimeter, with different copper coating thickness, as well as pure tungsten and pure copper chamber, and then checking also the effect of different damper setting, check the effect on the instability. And what we see is that for a 10 micrometer copper coating, so this is the red curve that is overlapped with the purple and the blue curve there, with a 10 micrometer copper coating, even without damper, we need a minimum chamber radius of 16 millimeter. And these 16 millimeter, they are well below the requirements that come from optics. Optics requires at least 22.5 millimeter radius coming from the bunch, the beam size inside the arcs, inside the dipole. So we have some margin from impedance compared to the current layout of the magnets that is shown here, where we have 23.5 millimeter radius, the 10 micrometer copper coating, then the shielding, and then the cold bore and the superconducting magnet core. Okay, so to summarize what I showed here, so coming back to this list of items that were identified by at the start of the collaboration in 2021, what I showed is some of the studies that were done. So this new beam dynamics regime during acceleration, the fast acceleration inside the RCS, the impedance model for the different machines. So these impedance models, they are available on GitLab. And also the mitigation measures that we need. One question was, do we need sextuples in the pulsed synchrotron? The US map study previously was did not conclude on this. So this is something that we could conclude. We need sextuples to give some chromaticity inside the RCS to mitigate the transverse instabilities. I did not show that in this slide, but other items were addressed. So I did some beam studies for the 10 TeV collider. We also developed together with the RF, the powering, the magnets and the optics team, an optimization tool for the RCS chain, because the difficulty with the RCS chain is that the parameter of each machine are linked together. So changing the injection energy of one is changing the ejection energy of the previous RCS. So then to optimize a chain of RCS, for example, to study the CERN or Fermilab seating, we developed this tool that is available on this GitLab repository. And there's even a web tool to play with the parameter and see which energy you can reach for a given RCS chain parameter. We also compared different approaches for the analytical coherent space charge estimation that is of particular interest for the proton driver, where the bunch energy are the bunch intensity are very high. So items I'm currently working on are the collective effects in the ionization cooling, because there we have very high bunch intensity, up to 40, 10 to the 12 muons and antimuons per bunch. We have many RF cavities in a very long kind of LINAC. And we have the wake field effects inside the liquid hydrogen absorbers that need to be studied. Another effect is the two-beam wake field inside the RCS, with multiple RF stations, as the second beam will leave a wake field in RF station in RF stations that can be seen by the first beam, and so address checking the effect this effect and what's the impact on transverse instability. Okay, so the general conclusion, as we saw, the muon collider complex offers a variety of different machines, each with different beam dynamics regime. What makes the complex difficult is the high bunch intensity, the fact that we need to cool down the beams and we need to accelerate them very quickly, pushing really the limits for beam dynamics, but also the accelerator technology. The collective effect studies are critical in all these all the components of the chain to ensure that we can reach the proper performance inside the collider. As we saw, we have to provide input for the RF, the magnets, the vacuum team for their design, and we also have to find mitigation measures if needed for the in the different machines. I just show some part of the effect. There's still a lot of things to do in the high energy part. So for example, so the beam effects, so when the two beams are crossing each other, I mentioned the two beam wake field effect as well, and also as well in the collider ring, the effect of the wobbling of the collider on the beam dynamics, etc. So my current focus now is on the collective effects in the muon cooling, where, as I said, we have this high bunch intensity regime with rather low energy, the relativistic beta of 0.9, a large number of cavities, and wake field effects inside the absorber. So really different regimes to address in this part. So I put some reference if you want to go further on some topics. And thank you for your attention. If you have questions. Sorry, people online.
Thank you, very nice talk. I have possibly a naive question. You may have answered this at the time and I just missed it. Slide 1920, you showed the example of the ceramic chambers from JPARC with the sort of the conducting strips on the outside. There we go.
This one?
Yeah. And then on the next slide, you show that for transverse impedance reduction, you need to have the copper coating on the inside of the chamber. Mm-hmm. But what you show there looks like a uniform coating, but you need the strips to avoid it melting.
Yes, this is, in fact, this was studied, well, for JPARC, in fact. It was, I think, Yokoya who studied this he found out that you can approximate the stripe for the impedance effect. You can approximate the stripe as a continuous coating or as a continuous layer, as long as the stripe are kind of close enough. So there is a paper, I can send it to you. It showed this, that, okay, this is a good enough approximation for this. But and also, one of the things, okay, in JPARC, there are different designs for this cavity. Here, it's the JPARC design where they have the stripes on the outside. For example, ISIS in the UK, they have the stripes on the inside of the chamber. So this is also something that was studied. Okay, so we put the coating inside, outside. What are the different configurations? This
one. Oh, yes, no. Thank you, John Gina. But following this, yes. No, just to say that indeed, at some point, it has to be checked also. You know, this is also like with the PIMs, RF fingers, you put many, not, and for some frequencies or for intensity range, you would say that it's fine. But at some point, there is also a limitation that will need to be carefully studied in the future as well.
Yes, the question is about your question to the, about the sex tuples in the machine, because you answered that we need sex tuples. Why? I didn't quite understand, because if you don't have sex tuples, you're running with natural chromaticity, which is high enough probably to damp the instabilities. And if you're afraid of the mode zero instability, you can have a damper.
So then we did a study with also natural chromaticity. So strong negative negative chromaticity, but the instability was even with the damper, the instability was extremely strong, and the damper could not correct it. So it was really the combination of both chromaticity and the damper that was correcting this.
But did then you work on the lattice also with the lattice? Maybe you
then
can,
okay.
You
then
can,
this was done. Yeah, this was done with the when. There was not yet a lattice for the rapid cycling synchrotron. Now we have we start to have the lattice design for the RCS. So this would need to be redone carefully with the lattice the proper number of RF stations, etc. Because the parameters evolve quite a lot.
Lots of options over time. I know imaginary gamma transition. I mean, lots of options.
Yes, but indeed, it's I think now in the lattice design for the RCS. There is the sextuples are included, but if we can remove them, it's less pulse magnet.
It's a trade-off. You don't want to complicate too much lattice design, just to remove sex. It depends. I mean, one has to look all the things in, put all in the same. Okay, thanks.
Yes, thank you. No, but linked to this, why, first of all, the question was raised. The question was raised because when you will accelerate, then you will have different orbit. So you will not be always in the center of the sextuple. So if you could avoid the sextuple, it's much better. Otherwise, you will have feed-down effects. Nevertheless, he showed that we need a certain chromaticity. So it's true that with natural chromaticity, depending on the value, it could be sufficient. Yes, but with the sextuple, you could better control the chromaticity. And as it is iterative, as you said, at some point, we didn't have all the information of the design and all this. So it has to be, it will evolve. We will iterate, as you said. Yes, exactly.
Also, the instability, what we saw that is that the instability is so sometimes so fast, it's not even multi-turn, but it's within one turn. We can have really between two stations or a few stations, the motion, the transverse motion growing, going very quickly. And if there is only one damper in a unit in the ring, we don't have the time to damp even the mode zero oscillation.
And another question, because you showed for the hybrid rapid cycling synchrotron district where have a baseline field with superconducting magnets, and then you have the normal conducting giving you the swing. Mm. Now, for the quadruples, what do you have? This is normal conducting, or
that's one of the big questions currently. That the quadruples will need to be pulsed as well, but then we will need also quite strong focusing quadruples. So there are some I don't know all the lattice options that there are, but there are some options with fixed field quadruples, superconducting quadruples, maybe embedded inside the superconducting dipoles, and then additional ramping quadruples that would also ramp from negative to positive polarity or something. But there's various lattice design options. It's studied by Lisa Soubirous. I think she showed last year the annual meeting different lattice options. But indeed, that's one of the study points. What's how do we put the quadruples in this to also not eat up too much the available space in the lattice because we need to put then the RF cavities in the lattice.
Then another question. Do we have also an estimate of what is the transmission efficiency, or do you have some goals?
I forgot to
guess. But one is because, in spite of the fact that the lifetime is getting longer because of the energy, still you will lose some for a lifetime consideration.
For the RCS, the let's say the machine parameters, they were set, they were laid out with the constraint of losing as much as 10% of the muon beam because of muon decay. So without accounting for any loss, classic loss, let's say, in the machine. So then all the RCS, all these parameters, so the acceleration, the energy increase per turn, etc., it comes from this 10%. And we see, in fact, on the bunch intensity figure, the decrease by 10% in each RCS. So this was the design. Was set with this this 10% loss budget per machine, and I think also for the then it was backward track to the target area. So say giving a budget for the cooling part, etc., to say we can afford this much muon decay loss in all the different parts of the machine. So we have in the interim report and full reports. Always tables of transmission, but just accounting for the muon decay.
And if we decide on these, then it's also the energy increase, yeah. The solar voltage is
computed. Now there is a specific voltage that we expect on average in the high energy part, 2.3 megavolts per meter, to limit the loss. That means for each factor 5 energy increase, you get 10% loss. And so that's how we do it. Now, at this moment, because we can do better at the initial Linux, actually the high energy part, the X-rating part, is performing better than what we set as a target, while the cooling is slightly worse. So that roughly compensates each other. But there will be some overall optimization to be done later, because this high sort of low loss at the high energy certainly costs RF. And so, but at least this can be nicely calculated, and that's all integrated.
At some point also, if I seem to remember, in some of the designs there were dog bone accelerators.
For the recirculating Linux, yes, the first design were dog bone RLAs. This was switched to, let's say, to pass Linux. In later designs,
and this has been abandoned.
Okay. Well, these Linux, they were in the part of the program that didn't have funding for. So actually, that's a request that we will have, that this now needs to be studied, because we need also to get the full chain going. I mean, but it was considered that the RCSs were more difficult and more also costly than the Linux. But we have a first solution for the RLA 2, which was done by somebody over the weekends. So a former student of mine, so we probably was learning a lot. So we believe that it is possible, but certainly it would need to be done properly. And like always, once you look into the detail, you will find things are that you still need to address. But to some extent there, is also a question of cost. I mean, you could, in principle, go for a single Linux if you wanted to, at some cost, and would like to avoid that. The other thing is now with the current design, we have, if we inject into the SPS, we don't yet have the updated lattices for that, but it's roughly similar. Yeah. Then you could actually also consider if you inject at a lower energy, which saves cost on the Linux. The old design from MAP started injecting at the RCS at 63. GV, because they wanted to have a Higgs factory on resonance without RCSs. But it is a totally, not necessary constraint. We just didn't have the time to actually investigate how much you could change the injection energy. But obviously, these first 60 GV, they cost something. And if you would just do another turn in the SPS, you would save plenty of money.
Other questions. How sensitive are you to the emittance, longitudinal or transverse, in this? Since this is one of the things you're not quite sure about how well the cooling will work. So
that's we Okay, we transverse emittance in particular, we I think we are very we need really to preserve it, so it goes into the luminosity formula. Longitudinal emittance as well, because the beta star is 1.5 millimeter target, so we would need to have a bunch length of 1.5 millimeter inside the collider. So we cannot, as well, for the longitudinal emittance, have too much blow up. So the simulation I showed where we have longitudinal emittance blow up through the RCS chain, it's because the RCS parameters were not fully optimized between each machine. But by optimizing the chain, we can remove this blow up. And then the goal is already with the, okay, including collective effects and just the transmission to preserve the longitudinal emittance. And then there are also studies from the RF side to see with the beam loading and all these effects to that the longitudinal emittance can also be preserved. But a figure like that on how much you lose luminosity by increase of emittance, I don't have the numbers in mind. I don't know, Daniel, if you have. It's proportional, yeah. It's for the transverse, it's proportional transverse emittance. So
I know the luminosity certainly goes as one over the product of transverse and longitudinal emittance. But just to say, I understand also you were concerned about the RCS, is the emittance they have to accept. And so the latest iteration on the cooling actually gives a transverse emittance that is only a few percent larger than the target. That was really recent, last few months, half a year ago we were still. And the longitudinal actually, so we did not yet change that in the design because we would like to verify, but the longitudinal would be even about a factor two smaller than the target, which will help greatly because we found, for example, for the RLA and I think also for the RCS, that the longitudinal emittance is actually maybe the more problematic one. And if that could indeed be smaller, then it would help the downstream systems. But we, for the moment, took note that we overperform in one case. We don't overperform in many places yet. But we will probably adopt that later. So there it looks less. Compared to the map design, we improved by a factor two in each plane. So.
Yeah. On the map, what the map reached and IMCC, current IMCC.
Should use the old fashioned plot because they're
the one in
logarithmic.
Yeah.
Like,
you know,
14,
25,
as you said, we are very close.
Well, at least one thing that probably is easier here because you don't have many turns all through the machine, and even in the collider, the survival is not. So here you plan to do also full tracking, I guess.
Yes. Yeah, that's one of the
at least is one of the problems that we don't have as compared to the to the LHC or the
I can I simulate with
the resources.
Yeah. No, because
there's also a special reason. I mean, one of the things that will have some impact on us, we don't know yet, that is the cooling. Many stages of RF.
Oh, yes, sorry.
The cooling consists of many stages of re-accelerating the beam in RF, and so the longitudinal shape is not really Gaussian. The transverse is reasonably well approximated by that, and then this is really transformed into the collision point. So we really would like to have the full beam with the real phase-based distribution in the collision point, because that would be really helpful. I think the outcome will be it is shorter, so that like with the beta function, I mean, you sort of have less of an hourglass effect with that. But that's all to be seen. Now, again, for the cooling, it's still difficult to simulate because there are some old-fashioned programs and some new ones, and we would indeed need somebody to put this together and have the injector Linux. So I will ask AVP group to help with these Linux and with the integrated simulations if we can get the resources.
It was also about the beam dynamics in this rapid cycling synchrotron is quite different as compared to what we consider so far the
synchrotron.
I'm wondering even, you said that you have huge QS and you try to distribute the RF all along the machine. I'm wondering also I guess that you will have dispersion almost everywhere in those, those machines. What happens if you start to have the coupling between transverse and longitudinal?
Okay, something that
I cannot imagine.
Just to mention that maybe if we use the LHC, we would actually group the RF in the straights. But still, we are also studying if it can be distributed. So there have been an initial study, because I thought that if you put cavities at the same dispersion locations, but with the opposite beta tron phases, then you get the first order cancellation. And Antoine actually checked that. And so it appears that within some accuracy that we will have to study in detail, you would actually get, you're allowed to put RF in dispersion regions, provided you do that in a clever way so that the effects cancel. We'll see if we will then in the end do that or group in Europe. Now, the other thing is that with the CERN implementation, both RCSs, the first one in the SPS and the first one in the LHC are single-sided only. So they only use normal conducting fast ramping magnets, and only the second one in the LHC uses this hybrid scheme. So that would make the design much simpler, because in that case, it's really like the optic scaling with the beam energy perfectly. And so that would be relatively stable and easy to compare to other.
I mean, there is, of course, this additional challenge for the RF in the hybrid RCS that it needs to sweep. And you slightly change the orbit. And I mean, especially if you have superconducting cavities, I mean, this is something that at least presently has never been done. So it would need to come in addition to the normal Lorentz force detuning and all the difficulties that one has already with superconducting cavities. So I think there are quite some challenges ahead, especially for the hybrid RCS, also from the RF side.
Thank you. Very nice presentation. I have a question concerning the variation of a closed orbit. So is it considered adiabatic enough that there is no budget in emittance blow up due to this closed orbit variation?
That's a good question. I don't think it's adiabatic at all, because that's we are talking like the RCS2, it's 50 something like 50 turns. So this is in between 50 turns. But I think Lisa made the first simulation, so with the optics, and without errors, stay for now. And she didn't have emittance blow up for this, but this was really the first linear lattice, perfect lattice.
It is like a curved linear accelerator.
Yeah, it's more like a linear.
It's not really orbit, I think, is even difficult.
Very interesting. But connected to the previous question, concerning the powering of these resistive magnets, perhaps in the simulation you are powering as a standalone magnet, while in reality they are in series, so there will be a bit of
that's part of the studies, I think, for the lattice design and the powering. How to also synchronize magnets that are in series one after the other, and so that they can follow the energy increase. I think Lisa, in this simulation, I think it's they take the real magnet ramp shape that is provided by the powering group. They did a big study for the how to power this magnet and how to synchronize all the different octants of the ring and to avoid any also energy or powering mismatch between different parts of the ring.
Thank you.
There was especially the worry initially we were looking into a sort of also directly linear ramp, which would be easy for the RF and then for the magnets. And For the magnets, for the power converters, they become really expensive because then you use passive firming networks, which came to a few billions. And so they have a model now that really synchronizes RF together with the magnet ramp, including the power converters, for to minimize the cost of the two systems together. And so it's an almost linear ramp, actually, that can be done, but this almost saves you quite some money. And so that I think that's quite advanced. And so there are designs for the power converters for that and for the magnets. And actually, next thing we should do is build some models and test them.
So if I look at your slide 31, it looks like you don't need copper coating at all in the collider. And you have lots of margin.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. It's, if we can keep this margin, etc., that could be that we don't need copper coating something.
There be some heating?
I think the copper coating, given the cost of the tungsten liner and the machining of the tungsten liner, adding a copper coating for impedance and the beam edge current is not the cost driver for this for the thing. So I would say it's we buy ourselves some more margin in case we have something we missed something in the impedance model or something like that. But
makes sense.
Yeah, it depends on the surface
route. Because this is expensive part,
maybe, but whatever you really would need to
But maybe the roughness is worse with well, I don't think so. But
tungsten,
you never know.
This looks comfortable.
I shouldn't say something like this.
Thank you. Of course, it would be the only, let's say, constraint we will put copper coating, but as we are well below the requirement for Montics, are you surprised?
Yeah. Good, I think if there are no other questions, I mean, you have seen from the number of questions how challenging is the...
No,
the project. No, I'm not afraid. I'm just saying that it's changing. I call them challenge. I'm not saying that. I mean, it was not negative, but I think I heard some time ago somebody saying that it requires a miracle at every step. No, but it's not true. I mean, definitely it's challenging. I think it's very interesting. I mean, it's a completely different. I think regime for many aspects. I think so. It's quite is definitely a challenging program. But I think what is also good is that there are people that are thinking and finding solutions. And this is what is
very interesting.
Definitely good. So thank you very much again, David, for
thank you.
Very interesting question.